This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another week of the Equal Agenda podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Imi.
And I'm Roman.
And today we are going to be discussing mainly about medicine, but a little bit about science too. So we'll be discussing women within these fields and how we kind of fit in.
Yeah. And so I guess right off the bat, we'll start off with our historical figure, an incredibly famous woman in the field of science, particularly, I think it's physics, Marie Curie, who was a Polish physicist. She was born Polish, but she lived most of her life out in France, and that's where she made most of her actual big discoveries and advances. Her sort of the biggest things attributed to her are to work with radiation and also discovering the elements, polonium and radium. I think she named polonium actually after Poland. And she actually, I think she won something like, technically like 3 Nobel Prizes throughout her life. She was initially awarded half of a Nobel Prize that she shared with her husband, also like a physics guy, a professor. And then they shared that with another guy because of a discovery that they had made about radiation. And then she was awarded a second Nobel Prize in chemistry just because of the work that she did with radioactivity. She did so much research, and she obviously discovered a bunch of stuff. And she also used that research to help during the First World War. She used radioactivity, essentially going around and like X-raying soldiers and stuff like that, and using it to actually diagnose and treat injuries and stuff like that, which is really cool.
Yeah.
She's not only a brilliant scientist, but she's also going out and applying that practically and helping people, and probably in a lot of cases saving lives. So that's really cool. She did also receive another award, which was not a Nobel Prize. It was a medal, which she again received jointly with her husband. Yeah, she was a pretty brilliant woman. Unfortunately, the stuff that she was like researching at the time, this was completely new. This was something that we didn't know pretty much anything about. What I've heard is that she used to sleep with a vial of like radium underneath her pillow every night. Ooh. And she did a lot of work in unprotected environments with radioactive materials like uranium ore. So she did eventually die of radiation poisoning. Apparently, another story, but I don't know if it's like completely true, that she was buried in a lead coffin because her body was so radioactive by the time that she had died. This is a woman working in a completely under-researched and in entirely new field. And she was, you know, she came out of it sort of worse for wear. She made a lot of achievements, and she contributed enormously to our knowledge of radioactivity and understanding of it. It's a shame the same can't be said for our knowledge and understanding of women's bodies and medicine.
Yep, which leads us on to our next point about the lack of kind of research and testing done specifically on female bodies. You would be surprised how long it took like physicians and researchers and like doctors to kind of just differentiate that the female body is very different to the male body. Like, it is not the same medically, so we can't be using these same practices all the time because it's just not going to work out well. And in terms of like experimenting and testing, I will take us back to the past, and we will discuss a kind of infamous James Marion Sims. He's known as the father of modern gynecology. He created the vaginal speculum, which is still used today, which is amazing and good on him. If he hadn't done it by excruciating experiments conducted on enslaved African American women. This guy was actually a monster, like, and I don't use that term lightly, but he would perform surgeries and tests and experiments on these women without their consent. They were literally like forced to do it, all in the name of science, but also because they believed, this is like a quote, that black women don't feel pain. Like, I'm sorry, but what the heck is actually that?
That's insane. You can't really call that science.
No, not at all.
That's... And because, like, the idea isn't... This wasn't done, I think, in any way for the betterment of women. This was more so some sick guy that was essentially trying to do what he thought was science. Because it's also sort of in the era of, like, scientific racism.
Mm-hmm.
Right, where they do apparent experiments on people that they consider to be, like, subhuman, in quotes. And the intersection, I guess, of being a woman and being African-American.
Obviously, it's a effed up thing to do, mm-hmm. but it's kind of... I feel like it's very disrespectful to the name of science to do that, because now, in my eyes, all your discoveries that you've come to, I think they're completely diminished and, like... are not valid to be held under your name because of the way that you've come to those conclusions. Yes, his most famous work is for the development of the surgical technique for repairing vesicovaginal fistula, which is a complication of obstruction of childbirth. But he developed these through non-consensual and without anesthesia.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they were awake for these surgeries on enslaved black women, and that is just horrific. Like, that is terrible.
It's actually pretty disgusting, because it's like no one's denying that like useful medical procedure out of it or medical tools. That's not really the point. There are other ways to understand and develop these things. There are other ways to understand people's bodies other than literally cutting them apart and doing experiments on them as if they are like inanimate objects, essentially. It's like the same...
You're treating them like lab rats. Like, they're literally human beings.
You're treating them like worse than lab rats, because yeah. I think at least with lab rats, or at least nowadays, you know, there are still like rules to follow. Like, you can't be unethical. You can't torture these animals. But what this guy was doing essentially amounted to torture.
Mm.
Like, these are real, even beyond, like, these are just human beings.
Mm.
And just the fact that you see them, well, because they're African-American, because they're a woman, they're somehow lesser and it's acceptable for you to be able to do these things. There is no way that you could even justify the claim that they don't feel pain, I don't think. I think that's delusional.
Apart from just being, like, blatantly racist, it's also so dismissive of women's pain. Like, mm-hmm. that is, like, historically, that is going to be a pattern throughout today's yeah. episode. It's just the dismissal and... disregard to women's pain. And it's just crazy that this guy is known as the father of modern gynecology, but yet he built everything he knows on the backs of black women, and then, like, they don't get the credit for it.
Yeah, no, it's like, I don't think he should be recognized at all. If anything, it's the woman who was subjected to those horrible things who should be recognized.
Anyways, moving on, we will talk about another example of kind of... This is not another example of the horrific experiments and testing that female bodies have had to endure. This is an example of the gap and lack of research done for women and female bodies. So you guys may or may not have heard this. It's pretty recent. Almost 30 years after the intricate web of nerves inside the penis was plotted out, the same mapping has finally been completed in 2026 for the least studied organs in the human body, the clitoris. So, as well as revealing the extent of nerves that are crucial to orgasms, the work shows that some of what medics are learning about the anatomy of the clitoris is wrong. So what we know... or, like, have been using has mm-hmm. actually been wrong. And this new knowledge could help prevent women who have had pelvic operations. So why did it take 30 years? That's my question.
That's a really good point. Because obviously there's no denying there's medical misogyny involved. But also, I guess what goes hand in hand with that is a sort of aversion to discussing... or even, I guess, researching, like, the what's supposed to be, like, the least researched organ of the human body. It seems to be, like, more of a taboo if anything, medically, which again makes no sense. But just because it has historically been so under research, I guess that like it just doesn't come to anyone's mind to actually look into this and think, oh, well, maybe it's actually different. Maybe there are nuances and complexities to this organ. And it's just insane that, yeah, 30 years after they did that for the male genital reproductive organ, they've finally done it for the female one.
This encapsulates the point that for so long, women weren't allowed to practice medicine and practice research. So for so long, it was only men telling. I'm talking mainly from a Western perspective, right? For so long, it was mainly men in those fields. So they are just basing it off what they have to work with and what they're thinking about. Like, they were not considering how it might be different for females.
And I mean, I think, well, from the what I've read, a lot of even very early on work about women's bodies, most of it was, if anything, just sort of speculative.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if like the sort of scientists, doctors and stuff that would do research, in quotes, about women's bodies would essentially just like guess.
Yes,
just
like literally guesswork. Like, oh my gosh, this brings me to the biggest point ever. Hello, what the heck is hysteria? Whose bright idea? Okay, I'm just going to give a brief history lesson about hysteria and what it kind of is and how it came to be. So from 300 BC to the early 1900s, if you were experiencing fatigue, dizziness, depression, nervousness, overwhelm, cramps, headaches, or even difficulty breathing, you are most likely to be diagnosed with hysteria. That is if you are a woman.
Mm.
You are most likely to be diagnosed with ladylike hysteria. The word hysteria is actually Greek for uterus. Hysteria was first used to describe a condition where the uterus would uproot and wander through the body.
What?
And cause all kind of issues. So the Greeks believed that these women were having these issues because the uterus was separating from the body and wandering around the organs because it longed for childbirth. It longed for childbirth, which
that is.
Is that not the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard?
The strangest thing I've. It's just what? Grows legs and starts walking around.
Pretty much. That's what they thought.
Ridiculous.
And I know that the Greeks had some pretty like crazy theories early on, but to me, that is just so unrealistic. Like, you're attributing all these women's pain to the uterus uprooting. Like, no.
I mean, it does remind me a lot of the so-called father of modern gynecology that you were just talking about, and how he believed that African-American women didn't feel pain. The Greeks, I believe, had a similar belief about women where they were essentially subhuman, that there was not as much of a concept of, like, gender as there was there's, like, humans. And then there's woman, and they're, like, below that. I think Aristotle believes something along the lines of that, like, oh, just some really crazy stuff about women are not only subhuman, but they're, like, monsters.
Yeah. And furthermore, hysteria, the Romans, not only the Greeks believed that crazy theory, but the Romans also had some interesting theories about what hysteria was and how it's caused. So they rejected the idea of the wandering uterus, but they believed that the issue of hysteria needed to be resolved by manual inducement of orgasms to help the nervous system. So they thought that these women's pain was caused by the nervous system being unregulated. So they thought that the solution was to cause these women to have an orgasm and all their issues would be fixed.
Wow.
Okay. Crazy. And if that wasn't crazy enough, later on with the growth of Christianity, hysteria still stayed in the picture but just took a different form. Physicians decided hysteria was now viewed as a moral issue and reflected satanic influence.
Of course it did.
So this is around the time of the witch trials, which Again, women's pain continued to be dismissed and undermined by these diagnoses. This kind of shift was more misogynistic and like shifting the blame to women being weak. Like, oh, you are feeling this pain. You have hysteria because you're weak and therefore you're susceptible to satanic influence, which is crazy. So the 16th and 17th century was particularly bad as women were thought to be more susceptible to sin with their symptoms. And that came with the accusation of witchcraft, which could be very fatal and have heavy consequences like death. Can you imagine going to the doctor today and being like, hey, I'm having shortness of breath, or hey, I'm having some heart issues. And the doctor going, sounds like you have hysteria. Sounds like you're weak. Sounds like you're a witch, actually.
Yeah, all because, sorry, we're burning you at the stake.
All because they can't explain it.
I mean, because, and the thing about that is, especially with this, it's a really convenient way to dismiss problems that women can have, not even just that are exclusive to women, but things like mental illness. If you have some like major depressive disorder, or if you are autistic, or if you have anything that's slightly like not, if you're not like slightly neurotypical and you're a woman, then it's far more likely that it'll just get classed as like some sort of female hysteria.
Yes. And this is what happened in the Victorian era. So Victorian doctors then decided that hysteria wasn't necessarily an issue of the body or the soul like previously, but rather your mind. So they decided that the best cure for emotional and psychological distress was to lock these women away, basically. They tried all sorts of terrible experiments and methods to cure these women of hysteria. Like, there was one case now that is known as the woman had postpartum depression, but their solution was, oh, we're going to lock. They just said, oh, you have hysteria. We're going to lock you away from your family, away from your kids. And that would have been so scary for that, like, lady. I genuinely feel so bad. Like, that would have been terrifying.
Yeah, that's not treatment. That's just torture. You're just locking people away. And the thing is, especially in the Victorian era with the sort of asylums that they would lock people in, a lot of these eventually became like freak shows that you could pay and go see. So I think that's hard to sort of reconcile the idea that, oh, you're supposed to be helping these people and then you're chaining them in like these dingy rooms that are like dark and damp, and having people go to gawk at you while you are probably suffering some of the worst pain in your entire life.
Yeah. Over the 20th century, the term hysteria was slowly replaced by specific, less gendered diagnoses. For example, postpartum depression, PTSD, epilepsy, anxiety, depression, PMD, PMS. But it actually wasn't until 1980 that hysteria was removed from the Diagnostic and Statistic Mental Manual. That is so recent. That is literally like not long ago at all. 1980. That is like, you're telling me in my mum's lifetime she could have been diagnosed with hysteria.
But the thing is, like, and that book has always had like a shaky history, the DSM. It was around the same time they removed homosexuality from it.
Yeah.
Or at least descriptions of homosexuality. And it's, again, it goes hand in hand with that, so the sort of patriarchal structures where things like homosexuality, which is like classed as like deviant or deviating away from the sort of hegemonic hierarchical masculinities, as well as just femininity in general, woman and their struggles are essentially relegated to the realm of things like hysteria. I just think that's outrageous.
So that's a little bit about the past of what it was like to be a woman and a patient back then. But even today, let's not forget that there is still so much lack of support for conditions that women face. For example, like endometriosis, PCOS, PMS, and PMDD. These symptoms are being dismissed and diagnosed too late. Endometriosis, for example, affects 1 in 10 women globally, but it still takes years to diagnose. it's women's burden of poor health is disproportionate to men's. Data and medical research has often been collected for men and generalized for women. So these diagnoses, they're created for men and then they're just being fit to fit a woman.
Yeah.
But it's not, it doesn't work.
It's like sort of also something that you learn at a very young age, maybe like year seven statistics, that you need a sample that's representative of the population as a whole. You want something that applies both to men and both to women, because if it applies only to men, then it's pretty useless, I think. That's, it's a no-brainer.
I guess this is something that I feel like particularly passionate about because I've had to face it firsthand. I've been trying to get a diagnosis for endometriosis. It's so difficult, and it makes it even more difficult if you're going through the public health system that's already so overworked. It's so unfair because you just have to put up with the pain, and it's like you can't even live in your own body because you just, I don't know how to describe it, but imagine going to the doctor because you've broken your knee. Broken your leg. Can you break your knee?
I think so.
You've broken your leg. You're sitting there and you're like, I'm in excruciating pain. This is impacting me every day. This is impacting my life. Mm-hmm. And the doctor just goes, okay, we're going to send you to like try this, or like, hey, we're just going to put you on this one medication and hope that that works. And there's not really any follow-up. There's not really any support for in the meantime when you're trying to get a diagnosis. And it's just terrible.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to put it.
It's like you've broken your leg and then they're sending you to the doctor who specializes in arms.
Yeah.
Because, again, there's a, maybe not misunderstanding, but lack of understanding. And there's, like, you just don't get the help that you need and the care that you need.
Yeah.
And it's not, I would at least like to think that it's not intentional, like, maliciousness on the part of the doctors.
Yeah.
But it's a systemic thing.
And I think doctors are often, like, trained to see, deal with what they can see and like what they know. And it must be, I would imagine it would be so hard when it's like someone's coming to you and they're like, with any chronic illness, someone's coming to you and they're like, I'm in so much pain all the time. But the doctor's like, well, I can't see that. Like, I can't work with what I don't kind of see. And it's like, would it almost be better if you like came in screaming and crying like you did have a broken bone or something like that? But I'm curious to know your kind of experiences within the health system.
Me, obviously the experiences of like a trans woman are going to be unique, but I guess also transitioning, the thing that I was told a lot, this is a thing that I was constantly told by people, was that taking hormones like estrogen and stuff like that would make me so much more emotional. Even my endocrinologist said, like, you know, oh, you're going to start crying at the end of movies and stuff like that. That never really happened. And I get there's the understanding that hormones can do that. But also, I don't know maybe if a lot of that might come from a sort of stereotype or generalization about the way that women act. I still don't cry at the end of movies, you know?
Like, and there's plenty of women who don't. Like, it's not a guaranteed thing. Like, no two women are exactly the same. Like,
yeah, exactly. And so you're like, I don't know. It's weird that, maybe it can be the case for some people. But again, this is, you're just generalizing woman.
Yeah.
And so you're telling me, oh, no, you are going to cry at the end of movies. And that's just not the case.
Yeah.
So I don't think you should be telling people
and
that.
And I think the biggest issues that I find is like generalization and dismissiveness of what individual is trying to tell you in that moment.
Yeah. And I mean, again, it's like, it's this assumption that, oh, because you're transitioning, because you're taking these hormones, you're going to be a completely different person to the person that you are like now. But like, I've lived 19 years before I started to transition. I think I have a pretty good idea of the kind of person that I am.
Yeah.
And I doubt that it's going to change just because I've started transitioning. I think that's strange.
If anything, it will just allow you to be more like yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, generally, I've been lucky to have a pretty good experience so far because most of the doctors and medical professionals that I've seen are supportive and I've not yet encountered any major medical issues. Who knows, maybe later on that's going to change and then I'm going to have an encounter that's going to be absolutely perfectly abysmal. I definitely am not putting that out of the question. And I do understand that a lot of trans women out there as well have really hard times with medical professionals, either having their experiences discounting or their feelings. Mm. Yeah, just not a great place for any woman at all.
Yeah. Okay, I know that this is a big episode and there's so much to cover, but I do really want to bring attention to a super important part of the conversation, and that is like women as clinicians themselves and as people in the medical and scientific field. The first kind of big thing that I'm basing this around is like nurses and what they have to face specifically in New Zealand. So there's still gender pay gaps despite being a female-dominated industry. This is from the New Zealand Nurses Organisation themselves. They say that harmful effects of this wage gap are being felt across the health systems in Aotearoa, New Zealand. They call for increases to health budgets funding so the problem can properly be fixed. This isn't just a financial issue. This is an issue of people being overworked and not being able to provide the care that is necessary to all patients. Like, typically our women, like it's a female-dominated industry, they are getting so much weight put on them from, like, higher above, like doctors, where they're like, it's like crumbling, like it's so concerning.
I mean, like the strikes and everything, a lot of people don't want to work in these conditions, especially because being a nurse, you will go through a lot. Like, patients will not always be the kindest to you.
Yeah.
Some patients can be aggressive.
Yeah. It's not an easy job.
It's definitely not an easy job. I will say, though, I will add on just the point of nursing being a very woman-dominated field is that there does seem to be like a sort of gendering of nursing. And I think especially it's more of like an outdated, but like the association of nurses with women.
Yeah.
Like the idea of being a male nurse used to be something that was like almost embarrassing for men to be. And it's gotten better with that, but I still think it's very heavily gendered. And it's this idea that women couldn't be doctors, so they are subordinated to, and not to downplay the role of nurses, but like to being secondary to doctors, to being like assistants almost.
Yeah, but that's even now, like that is how some nurses, like some doctors still view nurses like that. Mm-hmm. And it's horrible. Like, there needs to be a solution that works for all so that then nurses, doctors and patients can all benefit. And in particular, women get care that they need, they get seen, their pain is dealt with.
It is problematic, I think, the gendering and the sort of subordination of the role of nurses and just women in the medical field in general.
That's pretty much all we have time for. See you next week. Thank you for listening. Let us know in the comments any of your experiences if you're brave enough to share.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.